Today on the 21st Show, corn and soybeans are up while wheat and soybean oil is down. Do you know what any of that means? U of I agricultural economist Scott Irwin thinks you should, and his new book sets out to explain just that and share stories from his sometimes wild life experiences. It's called Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. I'm Brian Mackey with Scott Irwin for the hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, WNIJ in DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, the news. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Have you ever heard one of those agriculture market reports? Here's a little bit of one from this morning, produced by the RFD Radio Network.
December corn closing at 482 and a quarter, up 5 3/4. March corn up 5 1/4, 496 and a quarter. May corn 504 and a half.
Believe it or not, it goes on like this for nearly 2 minutes. Now, I'm not going to subject you to any more of it, but you should know that those numbers are of interest to a lot of people. Farmers, yes, but also high finance types who stand to make or lose fortunes by trading commodity futures. Now, at this point, you might be wondering, I'm wondering, what the heck is a commodity future? For that, we turn to the 1983 comedy Trading Places, where the Duke brothers explain the concept to Eddie Murphy's character.
Now, some of our clients are speculating that the price of gold will rise in the future, and we have other clients who are speculating that the price of gold is going to fall. They place their orders with us, and we buy or sell their gold for them.
Tell them the good part.
The good part, William, is that no matter whether our clients make money or lose money, Duke and Duke get the commissions.
Well, what do you think, Valentine?
Well, it sounds to me like you guys are a couple of bookies.
I told you he'd understand.
As I said, all this is of interest to farmers and traders. There's also a niche journalistic ecosystem around it, and it's the subject of academic research. And that brings us to our guest today. Scott Irwin is the Lawrence J. Norton Chair of Agricultural Marketing at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Irwin grew up in rural Iowa, a self-described farm boy. Today, he's a widely cited expert on futures markets, regularly appearing on Bloomberg TV, for example, and testifying before Congress and federal agencies. Irwin thinks more people should understand the role of futures markets, which he says are at the heart of our economy. To that end, he's come out with a book this year, co-authored with Doug Peterson, who's long been a writer at the University of Illinois. It's part memoir, part explainer, and it's called Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. Now, I taped this interview with Irwin a couple of weeks ago, on August 31st. Because of that, we're not taking calls today, but do keep in touch. As always, our email address, talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Scott Irwin, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to be with us.
Delighted to be here.
So let's start by talking about your background. You were an Iowa farm boy, like Captain Kirk. Almost everyone in your family had college degrees, though. Some master's or doctorates. You say that was uncommon in rural Iowa. What was it about your family that made them place this sort of higher value on formal education?
Well, I think it really started off on my grandmother's side of her family. And, you know, I don't really have a good explanation for the tremendous value that was placed on education, but it was a long tradition well before I came along. So my grandmother on my dad's side of the family, she had two brothers that had PhDs. Both were very prominent animal scientists, and including one who was a longtime swine nutrition specialist and faculty member here at the University of Illinois. And I discovered a few years ago that just by pure coincidence that I actually have the same office space that he does, or he did, excuse me.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. Odd coincidence.
But no grand theory of what made your family different.
No. Just a very high value on education going back, several generations. And that was really instilled in everyone as we grew up. So it was kind of just assumed that you would go to college. And if you had that desire, that you could go on for further advanced degrees, because there were examples of that in our family.
I want to talk, you have a number of adventures from your youth that are recounted throughout the book. Let's skip ahead a little bit, though, and tell us about the real ISU iceberg.
Oh, goodness, you would have to bring that up. It's one of the most infamous stories in the book. Well, all I can say is I was 19 and very foolish. And when I was a sophomore at Iowa State in the fall of 1977, Iowa State was having a very big international conference sponsored by the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia to explore the idea of towing icebergs from Antarctica to the desert in Saudi Arabia and perhaps other places, and make those kind of water-starved areas bloom.
And this is something people are still thinking about, right? You had a story in there about somebody trying to do this in South Africa.
Yeah, yeah, it's really an idea that's been around for a long time, but you get a bunch of smart aleck 19-year-olds who go, that is really sounds like a dumb idea. Now, maybe it is or isn't, but that's the way a 19-year-old minds work. And most 19-year-olds would just drop it and, kind of roll their eyes and go on. But no, not me and my friends at that time in life. So we decided that it was an idea so silly that it needed mocked. And this was back in an era where pranks were a big deal in college campuses in the area that I went in.
This is the Animal House era, right? It
was an all too accurate depiction of what campus was like in those days. And so we came up with the brilliant idea of that we would make a styrofoam iceberg large enough you could see. And the conference was held at the Iowa State Memorial Union, and they had this grand ballroom with large windows that faced out over, it was called Lake Laverne, a very picturesque lake right at the west side of the Union at Iowa State. And we knew that that's where the conference would start. And so we just thought, well, this will be fun. We will make our little iceberg, tow it around, have a good laugh while the conference starts, and everybody would think it would be this really, really funny prank. So that's what happened.
So you're doing the prank. Outrage ensues among some of the foreign student population. Disaster is averted, but you think you're about to be expelled. And I guess that's why the story is in the book, right? Because it sets you on this path.
Absolutely. It's definitely not an adventure that I'm proud of, and I included it in the book because I really can't tell my life story without that particular incident. Because, naturally, when the prank was over, we thought that, we were like campus heroes. We had a big party that night and celebrated. But the next morning, my fellow canoe paddler, where we towed around the iceberg, we were pulled into the Dean of Students office in Curtis Hall at Iowa State. And he was a very fearsome man named Dean Lewis Thompson. And he lit into us like crazy. You can imagine how embarrassing that was for the university. And I'm sure he'd gotten the message to do something to these two idiots. And little did I know that besides being the Dean of academic affairs and students when I was at Iowa State in the late 70s. He was also a giant in the field of agronomy, in particular on researching something called crop weather models, looking at the relationship between weather and crop yields. I didn't know that at all at the time. And so we got finished with the tongue lashing of a lifetime, in the midst of which I was sure I was going to be expelled, and I was already figuring out how I was going to explain this to my parents, when he kind of calmed down and told both of us that we were too smart, too good of students to be doing dumb stuff like this. And then as we were leaving, Dean Thompson pulled me aside and said, "Irwin, I want to show you something," in a big gruff voice. And he showed me a paper and pencil version of one of his now famous papers on crop weathers and yields. And as I say in the book, I was paying careful attention. I had no idea what I was looking at, but trust me, I was really paying attention. And so he wanted to encourage me to, you know, think about something besides, you know, stupid pranks and campus life and think larger about my abilities. And so he was showing me his research. And it was one of the first times someone really tried to explain seriously academic research to me. And then he did something that was really remarkable. In the midst of that, causing a mini international incident, he said, "Irwin, you're too smart for this stuff. You really need to think about graduate school." Imagine that, after what I had just, you know, embarrassed the university over. He said, "You need to think about graduate school." It was the first time, you know, my family, there was a lot of educational generalities out there. It was the first time somebody ever just pulled me out and said, not in my family, and said, "You're pretty smart. You should think about graduate school." And it made a huge impact on me. And I didn't calm down completely, but I really never had another serious incident as that after that conversation. And it really caused me to think a lot more seriously about what I was going to do. And like, it's a long, a little bit of a convoluted story. That incident and that exposure to those crop weather models is connected to a student and a major line of research that I now have in my portfolio here at the University of Illinois, investigating the relationship between corn and soybean yields and crop weather. So there is a direct line to that conversation with Dean Thompson and much of what I do in my research and writing here at the University of Illinois.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And you did connect with him, I think, when he was in his 90s before he died. And sort of he actually remembered you.
Well, who? From that. How could you forget, you know, a fool like
Ira? The styrofoam iceberg, yes.
Yeah, you know, you don't forget that, I'm sure, as an administrator. But, you know, it took me, oh my gosh, 30 or 35 years to get the courage to contact him again. So I did. I wrote him a really nice letter and sent him a copy of some research work we were done that was related to his research work. And he sent me back the nicest letter, a little humorous. He said, "You know, how could I forget you and your friends, Scott?" And we then talked about our mutual research interests. It was a lovely letter that I cherish.
Yeah. All right. So this sets you off on the path where you are eventually writing this book, Back to the Futures, crashing dirt bikes, chasing cows, and unraveling the mystery of commodity futures markets. And I should remind listeners, we're speaking with Scott Irwin, who's a professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, about this book. So let's talk about commodity futures markets. Sometimes we say on the show, like I'm a smart 13-year-old. Can you explain to me what a commodity future is?
Sure. It is a mystery to most people, but if you break it down, the best way to explain it is to start with, I think everybody understands what economists call a spot or cash market transaction. A farmer pulls up with a semi-load of corn to his local elevator here in Champaign County at an elevator and dumps it and sells it. We call that a spot or cash market transaction. It's the price and the transaction in the here and now. Well, farmers also have the option of using something called a forward contract. They can call their elevator up far in advance of harvest, say in May when they're planting, and if the price that the elevator is offering at the time for corn that will be delivered when they harvest it, that's called a new crop contract or a fall harvest bid, a farmer can take that. Let's say that, you know, this spring, that price was near $6 a bushel in May. The farmer can say, ah, that's a really good price for my crop. I'm going to call my elevator up and I am going to sell my corn I expect to produce that I'm planting right now ahead of time. We call that a forward contract transaction. It's the same as a spot market transaction, except you agree to the price well ahead of time. With that background, what futures markets are, commodity futures markets are simply trading of standardized forward contracts. So that's what they are. That's why there's particular reasons why that market institution has developed to trade standardized forward contracts. But at the heart of it, that's what they are.
All right. I think that made sense. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue my conversation with Scott Irwin. His book is called Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. It's co-authored with Doug Peterson, who has long been a writer at the University of Illinois. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Scott Irwin. He's a professor of agricultural marketing at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And his new book, co-authored with Doug Peterson, is called Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. I spoke with him back on August 31st. Before the break, we were talking about what exactly is a commodity future. And in this next section, we're going to be talking about the social utility and some who question the social utility of futures speculators. And we're also going to be just discussing some current issues in agricultural economics. Because we taped this conversation ahead of time, we're not taking calls live, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. When I think of what you described there, the farmer has used his or her labor to produce that corn. The grain elevator operator is using his or her labor to store it and transport it. The futures markets, though, a lot of the people who are involved in that are not. Right? They have no role. You write this in the book. They have no role in producing, storing, transporting, or processing the commodities they're trading. You write, quote, to the average person, they're just glorified gamblers playing fast and loose with the product of other people's labor. So talk more about, in your view, the social good that comes from futures trading.
Excellent question. It gets really to the heart of the matter regarding the value of commodity futures markets. So let's say that a farmer wants to take advantage of high prices at planting time. One of the ways they can do that is they can see if an elevator will offer a contract at current prices that they're satisfied with. Well, another way that they can do that is by selling contracts in the commodity futures markets. But without getting into exactly how that happens, they can do that and they can assure that they'll get that price that they like in the springtime for their crops that they're going to harvest in the fall. But all contracts have two sides. There has to be a seller and there has to be a buyer. And so if the farmer, for whatever reason, wants to make that sale using a commodity futures contract, say the corn futures contract at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, well, somebody's got to be on the other side of it. If they're selling, somebody else has to buy. And in theory, if there was another, what we call commercial trader that's involved in the processing or shipping or storing of commodities that wanted to buy it, like the local elevator, that's all good. But there's no assurance when that farmer wants to make that sale that there will immediately be somebody at that moment in time standing there willing to buy from them. And that is the function of the speculator. They step in and they take the side of the contract on a consistent basis with what we call providing liquidity to the markets to allow all parties to take the positions to hold price exposure in the way they want to in the most efficient manner. And that's probably the most basic way.
I'm a city boy. This is all Greek to me. But I should say my dad did actually work at the Chicago Board of Trade as a board marker when he was working for the railroad. He did that for extra money in the late 60s, early 70s. So we have a slight tie here, I guess.
Oh, yeah. That's remarkable.
But the thing I wonder, does everybody think they're getting something over on the other party in these contracts, right? Because why wouldn't the farmer, if the farmer thinks they can get more money by waiting and just doing the spot transaction we talked about earlier, why not wait? If the, you know, if the future seller must think they're getting a better deal than they would, you know, later, or what am I missing there?
Well, in the grand world that we live in, Brian, the wonderful thing is, as human beings, is that we can take the same data and we can take the same information or even just slight differences in information and come to very different conclusions about the value of something. It's the idea that differences of opinion make a horse race. And, you know, you're absolutely right. For a transaction to take place under normal circumstances, the two parties, the buyer and the seller, you know, have to be convinced that that's a fair price, even though they, in essence, have opposite expectations about price trends.
There has been a lot of attention to this over-financialization more broadly beyond commodities markets and agriculture. And I got to say, I'm a little sympathetic to that personally. I have some direct experience of this through the newspaper industry and what private equity has done there. Do you see over-financialization coming into play in the part of the world of finance that's focused on agriculture?
Well, not at least through the commodity market channel. I would say that's probably a different question if we're talking about, say, increased industrialization, vertical integration, expansion of mega production operations. If you want to put that in the bucket of financialization, that's one issue. What I research is a different part of financialization, which is the creation of investment instruments where people own take long positions in a basket of commodity futures contracts, in essence, to get some kind of commodity price inflation protection. And that really began to happen on a wide scale starting about 2004, 2005. And that's what we referred to as financialization in the commodity futures markets. And you know, it has been a large structural change in the players in commodity futures markets. And initially there was this argument that that kind of overwhelmed the normal functioning of supply and demand in the marketplace and created a series of giant bubbles in commodity futures prices, particularly in 2007, 2008. And that's what I spent a lot of time researching and debating.
I was going to ask you this a little bit later in sort of a current affairs section, but maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about that. Are we in an asset bubble right now in the Corn Belt?
That's a great question, which I was just out to the Farm Progress show in Decatur yesterday and talked to a lot of farmers and other people. And certainly a lot of interest in that question. Myself, again, I don't want to get into, you know, the technical language that economists use. I don't really believe that we're in an asset price bubble in the sense that asset values in the Corn Belt are dramatically disconnected from supply and demand fundamentals. But I think what we are struggling with is, like our entire economy, the asset values, I believe, have probably been driven up to an unhealthy level by the Federal Reserve's monetary policy that has driven down and held nominal interest rates near zero for at least short-term lending and saving, really most of the time since 2009.
What are the consequences of the U.S. losing its crown as King Corn to Brazil?
That's a really interesting question. I've already talked to a couple reporters about that today, and I talked about it in class, which I just came from. So it's probably more important in the short run on an emotional level. You know, great pride, I think, has been taken that we've been kind of the superpower of corn exports in the world for, you know, most of the last 50 years. You know, when I started my professional career back in the 1980s, you know, the United States might have been 60, 70% of total corn exports around the globe. So, you know, kind of unchallenged in the competitiveness and role that our corn exports have taken on. But for a variety of reasons, that competitive place has really been eroded over time. And I think what we're going through in corn is something similar to what we've already experienced in soybeans. As I told my students, I think it's important to keep perspective. It doesn't mean that U.S. corn exports are going to, in absolute terms, decline. And in fact, I expect that they will continue to grow in the future, but they're not going to grow as fast as our competitors' exports are, so we lose market share.
While we're on the subject of economic matters, current affairs in economics, I wonder what you think. We had a conversation recently on the program about the economy, and we were talking about that inflation spike that we saw, and I guess we're still in, although to a lesser extent than we were a year ago, certainly. But this idea out there that a lot of that was driven by companies sort of seizing an opportunity to increase profits and less about fundamentals like, you know, river levels on the Mississippi affecting barge traffic and avian flu affecting flocks.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
Well, clearly the evidence is very clear that, you know, let me at least acknowledge that in the midst of the worst of the pandemic, there may have been some literally price gouging going on for people that had very advantageous market positions. But I don't think that that could last very long because there's enough competition out there in the U.S. and globally in most of the agricultural markets. So the price spikes in agricultural markets were related to things like you said, you know, the logistics or inflation in labor costs, things like that. But that's also separate from the more general question about, you know, why has inflation in the last 2 years spiked so much in the United States? That's a much broader question than those kind of idiosyncratic factors that are unique to agricultural markets.
Where are you on the question of whether you think we're coming in for a soft landing, so to speak, right, as the Biden administration tells us?
Well, I was initially very skeptical that we would manage to pull that off, you know, when the interest rates started going up so much around a year ago. I was pretty confident that that would cause a recession. And right now, the data indicate that, you know, so far, there's a reasonable chance that we're going to have a softish landing. I'll put it that way. And I think that's really good and something to be celebrated.
What do you hear from students? And maybe students are even too young to think about this. I guess young people, I don't know if you keep in touch with former students, but so many of us have grown up in an environment in which interest rates were just low. That's what they were supposed to be, right? A significant share of Americans do not remember 10% mortgages or greater, and that was normal for a while. What effect do you see that having long term?
I think that there is no more central question or important question in thinking about our economy than what you just raised. And I had several conversations on exactly that point yesterday when I was out to the Farm Progress show, that, you know, the norm to basically say anyone under 40 is, you know, home mortgage rates of 3 to 5%. They can't even imagine rates significantly higher than that. And so I think that there will likely be some wrenching adjustments, assuming the Federal Reserve chairman and the Fed as a whole is really serious about getting inflation back to a target rate for core inflation of 2%. And I really got my students' attention on Tuesday in my class with this. I was really trying to bring this home to them, knowing that this was just like a foreign concept to them. So I had them in class do a little exercise. I said, let's assume that you want to buy a house for $300,000. You have to put 20% down. So that's $60,000 down payment and $240,000 mortgage. We're going to do on a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. The mortgage rate, say 18 months ago, was around 3%. Now it's right around 8%. So I kept the numbers, you know, really simple. I love teaching these days with all the electronic access that students have, because I could just say, all right, go out, find a mortgage calculator and do this. And that didn't cause any consternation. They just took out their tablet, their laptop, to their phone, and then they went to work. And it didn't take them long to come up with the answer. And I could see as they got the answer that they were just shocked. Literally, I could see the shock on their faces. The answer was, in round numbers, at 3%, that $240,000 mortgage had a monthly payment of about $1,000 per month. With 8% interest rates, it's now $1,700, a 70% increase in monthly finance costs for a 30-year mortgage on a commonly valued house at $300,000.
Let me take a minute to reintroduce my guest. I am talking with Scott Irwin, who, along with Doug Peterson, is the author of the book Back to the Futures. It's part memoir and part explainer and defender of commodity futures markets and people who speculate in those markets. We're going to continue our conversation after this short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's continue my conversation with Scott Irwin, who is a professor of agricultural marketing at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His memoir and explainer on commodity futures markets out this year is called Back to the Futures. I spoke with Irwin on August 31st. Because of that, we're not taking calls live today, but let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. I want to ask you a few questions about the Academy.
Mm-hmm.
You started teaching in the 1980s. What's changed most since then?
Well, I have to think about that a little bit. First off, I would say the thing that pops first into my mind is technology. I mean, goodness, when I started, it was common to use chalk and chalkboards. I did that for a long time. Then I switched to an overhead projector and transparencies. That was high technology in the late 1980s. And just, you know, how different, you know, going into a classroom is in terms of access to information. I mean, I love the example that I just gave you, Brian, of, you know, everybody's got a phone or a tablet or a laptop with them. And you can say, here's a problem. I don't even have to give them the tool. They just go out and get it in a few seconds and do it. Now, they can't do that with everything, but I love it. I love the technology because what I teach about commodity markets, you know, prices and issues are changing every day. And so I take the first 5, 10, 15 minutes of every class period and just riff on what I think is interesting going on in the markets. I just feel like a kid in a candy store as a teacher about how easy it is to kind of bring my subject to life with the access to the web and all the tools that brings. And so for me personally, that's the biggest change. And I really, really like that. The second one, you know, you got to be careful when you've been doing this as long as I have. And there's such a big gap between my age and students now. But it's interesting. Students seem to me to be harder to engage today. And I've really struggled to kind of figure that out. Some of it's post-pandemic, but even before then, students seem a little more passive than when I started it out. I guess they were more prone to fight about points and grading and just engage with you, it seems like to me, than they are today. Maybe it's just they think I'm an old grumpy professor and why bother? could be part of it. But those are my two observations.
Yeah. Somewhat tangential, but you have been at Purdue as a student and Ohio State and U of I as a teacher. So is the Big Ten too much big and not enough 10?
Well, I'm not exactly sure I understand your question, Brian.
I'm getting into the athletics and the expansion.
I'm sorry. I'm
no,
a little bit
right.
Slow. Wow, we could really go off on that. I definitely have opinions on it.
I mean, Seattle to Rutgers in a few years, right? It's no longer your Big Ten or my Big Ten.
And I understand why it's happening, but as a fan, and I'm a big sports fan, I really don't like it because, you know, like I used to say in my work life, my professional life, most of my adult life, you know, wherever there is a land-grant college of ag and Big Ten basketball, that's where I want to be. And I think the real danger about what's going on with, in particular, it's mainly driven by football, men's football, and to a lesser degree, men's basketball. There's a real danger of killing the goose that laid the golden egg, which is when the players are all paid, and then I actually, as an economist, I think they deserve to be paid their fair wage for what they're doing. But in doing so, in making all of that more equitable, the question is, will fans like myself still like it as much? And I think that's a huge issue that is we're going to, and we're obviously going to test that.
I appreciate you offering a hot take there. Another place you do like to get engaged is on Twitter, or I guess if we have to, we can call it X. Would you encourage more colleagues to be active on Twitter?
I've had that question a lot, and my honest answer is probably not, because it's a little bit of an odd beast, is that to be effective on a social media platform like Twitter, you have to be all in. And I would certainly be all in the amount of tweets I send out. I think I saw recently that I've sent out since 2014, I think maybe 25 or 30,000 tweets. So that's a lot, certainly by academic standards. But
29. That's your number of followers. I'm sorry. I guess they don't list the number of tweets on there publicly
someplace
anymore.
It's on there. Okay. It used to be, but it's.
Well, you have 29,000 followers, so that's a significant base for an academic, I think, in this day
right.
and age.
And so it's my recommendation to colleagues is leave it alone, unless you're willing to be fully engaged, because you're really not going to get much out of it. You'll be frustrated and you won't understand why nobody's following me. There's not much engagement because you don't understand what people are looking for on a platform like Twitter from academics. You know, announcements of conferences, I published a new paper. Here's a picture of me with a graduate student that just finished. Those are all nice. Those are great things that we should celebrate and share with each other. But that's not where large number of people in the thousands are going to find value from an academic. I kind of started with that mindset. I started on Twitter in the summer of 2014 or 15 and completely naive, never tweeted, didn't have any idea what I was doing. And so I've made every kind of mistake on Twitter you could imagine in terms of what's effective or not. And it took me about a year, but what I discovered, what people really valued, because it's easy to track, you know, the popularity of, or usage of your tweets, is they wanted to know what I thought about something to do with markets, policy, economics. And a light bulb went off when, this is really how old and long I've been on, and I said, I'm going to use Twitter as my 180-character micro blog and really focus on sets of threaded tweets where there was elements of analysis, opinion that was unique. And then I found my voice, and it's also, you have to have kind of a personality where you can withstand the, what I call, Thunderdome nature of Twitter. You're going to get people say really mean stuff about you. That you get a, kind of a constant barrage of sometimes negative feedback, and it's okay. I have funny stories about that. That's just part of the kind of cost of engaging in Twitter. But I have found that cost is very small relative to the platform that it has given me to get my ideas and my thoughts and my analysis out there.
In the few minutes we have remaining in our time together, I do want to talk about global warming, which may be the issue of our age, depending on your perspective, I suppose, and depending on how we respond to it in the coming years. But this has really become politicized in our country. Mm-hmm. It's also the lived experience of a growing number of farmers. How have you seen farmers' views on this change over time?
Well, I think it's really interesting to divide this into kind of, there's a political view, everybody knows that farmers tend to be
politically conservative.
Yeah, we can be clear about it. I mean, the farmers tend to elect representatives who are most opposed to taking, you know, collective action on global warming, right? I mean, you can line up that map.
and probably some of that is just ideological. Some of it is a well-founded fear that that will impose added cost onto their added production costs that will be hard for them to pass through to ultimately the consumer. And so probably legitimate fears there. So that's one level. The other level is more on their, I guess you would call it, their lived experience on their farms and what they see in terms of what's happening to the weather, more extreme events, a longer, wider growing season. And they are acutely aware of those kinds of impacts. And if you frame it that way, you're going to have very interesting conversations with them. That's been my experience of talking to farmers about this issue.
Do you think our markets are effectively pricing in the externalities of global warming?
Oh, that's a very complicated. That depends on how severe you think those externalities are, and that is something that I haven't written a lot about, but I have views on. For example, here's the way I put it: I don't doubt my fellow scientists' research about potential temperature increases. But what I'm really disappointed about is the research that I've seen in the economics field that doesn't seem to understand or able to account for in their analyses of the impact of climate change on agriculture is the scope for farmers to adapt. For example, now this is simplistic, but you know, let's say it gets 50 years from now or 100 years from now, too hot for corn to pollinate effectively in July in Illinois. Well, if you give Illinois farmers the same soil, improving technology, or even the same technology, and we do not need that plant to pollinate in the now much hotter temperatures in July, as long as you give Illinois farmers a four-month window where there's at least 4 inches of precipitation a month, and that's temperate temperatures through that four-month window, they'll just move the planting to that window. You know, we can, you know, if the weather dictates it, we can plant corn in Illinois in February and harvest it in June. So one of the things that I see that's really missing in terms of climate change impacts on agriculture is not nearly enough attention is paid to precipitation effects, which my understanding is that that's the least well understood part about climate change. But I do know this, that if you have a temperate period with at least 4 inches of precipitation on average over a 4 month period in Illinois, wherever that is, we can grow corn and soybeans just fine.
And derechos and everything else increasing there, Tornado Alley moving to the east?
You know, all of those things can have an impact, but I would argue those are, you know, unless we're going to get, you know, super derechos, you know, a couple times every year and it just wipes out the whole Corn Belt, and I haven't seen anything like that.
Coming soon from Michael Bay.
Yeah, exactly. You know, my point is, farmers are ingenious and creative about producing their crops and livestock, and there's enormous scope for adjustment to deal, especially over with changes that are occurring on a multi-decade scale. And so I'm not a Pollyanna that says everything will be fine as the climate changes. My voice is, don't forget the scope for adaptation by farmers to those changes.
Well, this has been an interesting and wide-ranging conversation. Scott Irwin, thank you so much for being with us on the 21st Show.
I really enjoyed it, and thank you very much for having me on the show.
The book is Back to the Futures, Crashing Dirt Bikes, Chasing Cows, and Unraveling the Mystery of Commodity Futures Markets. Scott Irwin, professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, co-authored with Doug Peterson, who's been a writer for the University of Illinois for more than 40 years. That's all the time we have for our program today. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.